Welcome to the season three of the Avant-Garde Perspective Podcast. To those lurking and listening, this is the adult section, so if there's kiddies in the room, you might want to put them out or put your hands over their ears. It's a human library of laughable, ludicrous, lamentable stories. Every guest answers the same questions, and their answers reflect at times an unconventional, unprecedented, prodigious, forward-thinking perspective because of how they responded to the plot twists that life handed them. On this podcast, the story and the author is the one and the only, alive, living in captivity, somewhere in San Francisco, California, Vincent Lau. How are you, Vincent?
I'm great, Paul. How are you?
I'm doing good. Did I get your last name right?
You did. You did. Perfect pronunciation.
And how are things in San Francisco tonight?
They're great.
Oh, good.
It's going to get cold, but it is close to Thanksgiving here in the U.S., so, you know, it's right around that.
Yes. It's cold. You've got Thanksgiving and you've got Black Friday.
Black Friday sales.
That's all we know about it. Canada. Oh, it's Black Friday. Actually, it's interesting. My partner, Ben, whom you know, his brother and sister-in-law live in California and in San Francisco, and she works for Air Canada. And she said that Black Friday is one of the largest days for Air Canada for people coming in for Black Friday. So she said we have more people coming
flying into the U.S. to participate.
Oh yeah, yeah, unbelievable!
That makes sense, though. That makes a lot of sense.
Needless to say, we don't have tickets for that. But anyway, hey, listen, Vincent, let's jump into this. And let's start with that first question. If your life up to this point were a book, what would the title be?
Oh, I would have to call it
The Beehive,
except it's different.
Okay.
You know, I started, and I kind of name for my place, which was, I used to hang out at my place every Friday or Saturday. We're hanging out at the Beehive. And so it, and I just kind of stopped.
I like that. When you were growing up, was it the same, like wherever you were growing up, you know, your place tended to be the Beehive, or is that just something that's happened in?
The Beehive came about, you know, maybe in my 30s. But yeah, I mean, you know, my friends, you know, we just never called it the Beehive then.
Yeah. When I was growing up, our place always seemed to be the hangout, you know, for my friends and that. They always, you know, I don't know why. But yeah, it was sort of like we land at my place and then we go from there. You know what I mean? You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. You know, I think even as a young, my used to always just so central. That if we wanted to party, everything was right there. You know, my place is the perfect for everyone to meet.
Well, that's good. Well, let's look at this life of yours from the perspective of the Beehive. So my understanding is you were born at a very young age in the Philippines.
Yes, I was born in Manila.
Ah, yes. And so what was your childhood like in Manila, growing up in Manila?
Oh, my gosh. You know, I think that a really, really fun childhood. I used to live my dad's. The compound had three. And one, my grandmother and my uncles lived with her in that house. Another house was with me, my dad, and my older sister at the time. This was before they were born. So I was always surrounded by family. Mm-hmm. Doted on me, so that was kind of fun.
So you were spoiled. Is that what we're saying?
I was the first grandson. So my
oh my god.
They doted on me. No, barely spoke any Tagalog.
Okay.
Cultural thing. Male. And we're just. And just spoiled, I guess you could.
As spoiled as you could be in.
It was a fun childhood.
Okay. So, I mean, your home life, as you just said, was surrounded by family, which is a good thing. Sometimes I look at today and the way kids are growing up, it's that whole, they're missing the family aspect. I mean, grandparents are on one side of the country. And I mean, there's just not that, you know, close proximity anymore.
You know, in the Philippines, thing where you know you
I think so too.
The Albert lives together, and you know, I was just lucky that also one of my uncles and aunts got married, so just me and my older sister. You know, being
wow. Back up here, you were the chaperone for their date.
Along with dating their friends. Yeah, it was fun.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sure it was for you. May not have been for them, you know?
Maybe not for the boyfriends, right?
Exactly. No. Wow.
My uncle, who's now married, he's really... Well, he's a second father. Yeah, he still lives in Manila with my aunt.
Oh wow!
Yeah.
Do they come to San Francisco or is it mostly you go there?
You know, they traveled to the U.S. recently. My uncle is now in his late 80s. So.
Oh, okay.
Health-wise, so I try to visit. I can, so you know, one of the goals, obviously, is main goals is my aunt and my cousins.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
And I did fun some research. Oh, okay. That is very good. I mean, one of the things that I've enjoyed, I do enjoy hearing about in the Philippine. Culture is that closeness of family, and you know, I mean, you just it's so valuable and important. You know, I think it's a challenge I find for some of the Filipinos here that I talk to here in Canada, where it's not the same. You know, Ben's children. I always often tell him. I said, "Your children are bananas," and he said, "Why?" I said, "Because they're yellow on the outside, but they're white on the inside." You know, and so they don't appreciate the Canadian. They don't appreciate the Filipino culture. They want to say, "Oh, yeah, we're Filipino in culture, but that's we're more Canadian." Do you know what I mean?
You know, American and Canadian are different in that way. Everybody lives mm-hmm. in far off places from one another, first of all, because
right,
because they all live together and different culturally. I mean, not to say that it's there, but you know, it's very
well. I sometimes think that, and I've said this to you too, Ben, is that. You'll probably find once your children start getting into their 20s and 30s, they will begin to appreciate when I'm sort of getting back into their roots and, being that whole, learning more about their roots and, where we come from and what's key and important. But although one of the things I do enjoy here in Canada, and I'm sure it's the same in the U.S., is the multicultural aspects surrounding us. Somebody asked me the other day, what do you classify as Canadian food? And I said, wow, I don't think I've eaten Canadian food for like 20 years. I think it's burgers and fries. But I said, usually it's like, hey, let's go for let's go for some Chinese food or East Indian food or Mexican food, or, otherwise I find the rest blah, a little bland.
So it's Canadian food, burgers and fries too. So it's very American.
Yes. We'll say things like maple.
I get it.
Yeah, well, I mean, no, gosh. Yeah. Well, that's the challenge, because anytime you say that, people go, oh, well, that's the same as the United States. I said, yeah, you know what? I mean, other than we probably lay claim to things like maple syrup, but you sure don't want to put that on everything. And, it's not something we have on the table all the time, but
that's right,
man. I guess. But yeah, that's you know right. what? I mean, I grew up in a household where my dad, I mean, he liked meat, potatoes, and vegetables, beef or chicken, not very often fish, and you always had potatoes and you always had vegetables, and it was sort of really bland, actually.
Similar.
Once we all get out,
we ate nothing but Filipino rice, whatever meal.
Listen, the Filipino food, the first time I was introduced to it, we do a Canadian Thanksgiving. So our Thanksgiving is in October, and it's the full turkey and everything like that. But at Christmas time, we do a full-on Filipino meal. And the first time I ever had this meal, it was like, where are the vegetables? And it's like, well, they're there, but they're deep fried. Everything is deep fried. I said at the end of the meal, hey, everybody, listen really carefully and quietly. You can hear my arteries hardening. I'll probably have a heart attack some night in the night. It's like,
it's
unbelievable. Oh, my gosh. It was just like, you eat like this every day? Oh, my God. This is not healthy.
You love but food in the Philippines.
Oh my gosh, that just like unbelievable. So let's move this into your school. So you schooled for your younger years were in the Philippines.
What are you talking about?
From first grade to
you junior, did. He said, I wrote the name down, and if I can read my writing, it was the Philippines Pasay Chung Hwa Academy.
Oh, it's Philippine Pasay Chung Hwa Academy.
Oh,
close enough.
And so, my understanding of there is I got the impression from him that school was it's very regimented,
Well, we went to a school where it's a Chinese school as well.
Oh, okay.
Study Filipino and English. And in the
okay.
Our Chinese classes. And regimented in a too.
Mm-hmm.
Then. That corporal punishment was not unusual in school.
Well, mind you, when I was growing up, it wasn't either, it's amazing when I look back of the fact I watched a teacher throw one of my friends out, like out of the classroom, like literally throw them out. I'm like, when I think back to it, I think, oh my God, there'd be lawsuits all over the place here.
We're probably aging ourselves by discussing our
Oh, no, you're way younger than me, you know. I mean, I'm talking about when we had to go stagecoach and take horses and, you know, climb a mountain.
Horse.
Oh, yeah, I remember we'd have to fight off a dinosaur or two, you know. I mean, oh, that's how old I am. But, I mean, you're talking much younger. They had invented electricity by the time you came along.
No, we just rode jeepneys.
Oh, yes. Oh, my gosh. When Ben tells about the jeepneys, it's like, when he tried to explain it to me at first, I was like, what? And he said, no, I'll have to show you. I'll have to show you the pictures. And it's like, oh, my God. But he said,
they're
yeah.
Very
he said,
they're very jeeps. Called on American car jeeps that were.
Okay.
You know, morphed into designed a jeepney, 14 maybe to 16 people sitting, not counting.
Even then, I can't. Yeah, I mean, when he shows me pictures, I'm like, "You went on that like as a kid?" He said, "Well, it's the way we got around, you know. I mean, unless you had a bike or something like that, but
uniquely Filipino."
Yeah. Yes, yes, absolutely, absolutely. And so, well, that's true. That is true. Because when we were looking at going to the Philippines, that was, I start doing research, obviously. And it's like, oh, these jeepneys are like, that's like major. It's almost like, don't go to the Philippines and not experience the jeepney, you know? It's like, oh, okay.
Primary mode fun. Of transportation for millions and millions and millions of people. So
it's... that, yeah. Well, I always laugh when people talk about like the Asian countries, you know, we're talking millions and millions of people. Where when I think of, I mean, here in British Columbia, our province, we probably, I mean, we have over a million people, but I mean, we're well spread out. So, the city of Vancouver is not a million people.
Well, that's what it is. You know, the population is 100. You know, when I left the Philippines in the late 80s, 54 million at that time.
Wow, it's
very busy.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, I was gonna say this. Do you have no TV? You don't go to the movies? Is there no internet? It's like, the women were probably glad when TV came along. You know, it's like, oh, thank God he's got some entertainment.
Children are such a blessing to even after a child, it's still a blessing.
Your parents didn't have 12 children or anything like that, did they?
Oh. Like... Dad had four. They planned
Well, I always think it's really funny because I have four brothers, and you know, when I say to people, oh, you know, there's five of us growing up, oh my gosh, such a huge family. Not really. Back then, it was you had a whole bunch, you know.
Not for the Philippines.
Just in case one got sick or, you know, whatever. That one died. We got four more. Don't worry about it. We know how to make them.
Well, my dad was part of eight, so, and my mom was part of 12, I think.
Well, my ex-wife came from a family. She had seven sisters and two brothers, a French Canadian family, farming community. And she and her, my wife at that time and her twin sister were the last ones born. And I remember saying to my father-in-law, I said, Claude, I said, wow. I said, yeah, that's a lot of kids. And I said, why did you decide to stop? And he said, He had this look on his face. He's like looking around, and then he gets really close to me and says, when they started coming out two at a time, it scared me.
I thought you
so
did.
No, he actually thought his sperm had really become super sperm, and he thought, "Wow, they're coming out at twos. I got to stop this. This, no, no, we're done. We're done."
There's so many. My grandmother and my grandfather probably didn't have a tea.
But I mean, you think about the fact that they have these large families and not huge mansions of houses, you know. Yeah. So it's like, wow, when did you do the deed, folks? It's like,
exactly. I'm sure they were very creative.
I'm sure they were, and I don't want to know. I really don't want to know. So did you went to public school in Manila, and then you went on to high school? What's that?
We went to, actually, in the Philippines. It was a private school.
Chinese. Right. Yeah. That's right.
It's considered private.
Okay. Oh, I know what I was going to ask you. The one thing I was going to, Ben was telling me his mother would bring his brother and sisters, like, and him, their lunch every day. Like, she would come and, you know, cooked it and brought it to the school. It's like, you are kidding me. My mother would never do something.
Up to a certain age, it was either the nannies that would bring, you know, the lunches to school, or my. And then at some point, it graduated into buying food outside. Yes.
Yeah.
Very common in the Philippines.
Wow. Unbelievable. I thought it was just him, but now I'm here. Wow. You're all spoiled. So you went to a private.
Back then, there were no microwaves, or there, you know, it was.
Yeah. No TVs, no microwaves. If I stayed home for lunch, the old man would want to knock me up again. So I'll take the kids their lunch every day. Get away from me. You'll be back to work by the time I get home. You know, I digress. So, and then you went on to high school.
Yep.
And from now, you said to me that you that's when you went to the United States. They headed over to America.
I actually stopped school after my junior year in high school, thinking that our trip to the United States was imminent, and it ended up taking longer than it did. So I actually, that's why I say that I went to school with Ben from first grade to third to junior year in high school, is because he kept going and I stopped for a year.
Oh, okay. So you just didn't go to school.
Thinking I was coming to America. So I told my mom, well, what's the use of going to school now? I'm going to be going to the U.S. pretty soon. But it actually took a little bit longer than we anticipated.
And she agreed with that? She said, yeah, go. Yeah,
you know, she thought it too. She thought we were, you know, she thought the rest of us were going to be immigrating. But our papers took a little bit longer.
Okay. And then, so how old were you when you came to America?
I was at.
Wow.
20 years ago.
And
15 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I thought. So. Wow. My goodness. Right after movie theaters were started. So what was your impression of America when you came to the United States?
Honestly, my first year. Actually really
oh really
it. You know, at a time I was 17 years old, I was a teenager, and you know, I was really enjoying my life. I was hanging out with friends, you know,
right,
but you know, the hate probably came from culture shock. It was very, very different, you know. Life here in the U.S. is very different, so it was. That's why I say the first year was transition. And, you know, in many ways, you know, lifestyle, you know, being in the closet, you know. So.
Oh, okay. And what about the, what about your English? It was, you were fluent, or?
You know,
or did you?
I always speak a very different way compared to, you know, I think that's why, you know, when I was in school, my teachers used to like putting me in speak and orate and things like that, because maybe my English was so good. And I credit Sesame Street.
Oh, okay. I can speak in front of the class, but I have to be in a garbage can, okay? And I like cooking.
Well, that's how I learned, you know, that's how I learned my English in the beginning. Yep. Was maybe I well, watched it a lot we more have than a... the rest of my schoolmates did.
Well, our international high school student that is with us, he's Japanese, and he will often watch Canadian cartoons, English cartoons, and that's how he learns his English. You know, because it's at a night easier. I mean, he's fluent. Actually, I don't know why he does that, but he says it helps him with his English when it's at that level. So, yeah, but I mean. I'm thinking now you're 17 coming to, you know, the US, whole new culture. Now, were you came to California or
Southern California?
Southern in California. LA, okay.
Whoa. Lived there up until I was 30, and then I moved to
Now, did you live at home until you were 30?
No, you know, I was within the year that I, you know, when I came to America, I was maybe trying to explore I was itching to kind of house so I can just kind of explore and have fun.
Okay.
To my own place.
Oh, wow. Okay.
18.
Wow.
I look back good at it you. Now, and I was like, "Wow, I young, you know, fun."
Well, you know what? To the shock of many of our friends that are Asian, I always tell them that when we were growing up, all of us got the same birthday gift on our 18th birthday, and that was a set of luggage. That was my parents' way of saying, bye. I don't want to be, you know, we don't want you home. I said to my mother years later, I said, Mom, I mean, you gave us all luggage. What would you have done if we'd have continued to stay and live? She said, your 19th birthday, your clothes would have been in your luggage. You know, she wanted, it was like, Western. Time to fly. Yeah. But I mean, it was like, get the hell out of my house. Yeah. As soon as my last brother headed out of the house, my dad came home from work and my mother was sitting in the kitchen with a real estate agent. He said, what's going on? She said, David, we're selling the house. And he said, what? Why are we selling the house? She said, I was talking to some of my friends. Their kids went out the front door, went to university, came in the back door with a girlfriend and moved in with them. Ain't happening here. We're going to sell and get a condo, a two-bedroom condo.
Good for them.
And that's what they did. Yeah. You know what? My mother was like, I've washed and cleaned and done everything. I want to enjoy my life now. You know, my good poor dad, them. He was just so upset. It's like, because the second bedroom, she put in a really cheapy bed. And my dad was like, no, what if the boys come and stay? She said, well, they can stay for a little while, but I don't want them to get too comfortable.
Wow, it's usually you would think that it's usually the dads who say that, and then the moms are the ones.
Yeah,
who...
no, my... yeah, my...
Well, good for her.
Listen, my mother was a very unique person. On their 50th wedding anniversary, I said to her, wow, Mom, you and Dad have been married for 50 years. Like, that is amazing. Amazing. And she looked at me and she said, you know, Paul, when I was standing at the altar as a young bride and the minister was saying, and we were saying, you know, till death do us part. She said, it was so like a romantic feeling. And I said, oh, that's really nice. She said, now it's a goal. It's like, I'm going to outlive that bugger and enjoy my life. But
good for her.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Now, listen, you've hinted at it a couple times about, you know, coming out. Obviously, some of the people that will listen, and I get this question all the time, as I'm sure you do, you know, how old were you when you first knew that you were gay?
Oh, my gosh. I think even as a small child, I was showing signs that I was gay, because I remember even as a little kid, you know, or even family would casually kind of say something that they kind of knew. But, you know, even as a young boy, I always had crushes on cute men. Not on girls or not on women. It was always men.
My older brothers, after I had
these Filipino movies, and I would think, oh my God, that actor so-and-so is so handsome.
So, my older brother said to me, oh my God, Paul, it must have been hell for you growing up in our home. Like, you know, I mean, we were all, you know, our jokes were about fags and, you know, like, how did you handle that? I said, you know what, guys, you had some really hot looking friends that would come over. I said, that was fine. I could live in that world. It's like, wow, nice.
You know, you kind of normalize these things, as you know, when you hear it a lot from a very young age.
Yeah.
You know, keep it to yourself. But
Well, I mean, people do say to me, you know, oh, well, why did you wait till you were 40 to come out? And I said, well, here in Canada, if they found out you were gay, I mean, they'd throw you into prison or give you a frontal lobotomy. So, I mean, it's like, let's stay under the radar.
Oh, my God. That does not sound fun.
No. I mean, it was a different world back then.
Yeah, I mean, even in the Philippines, you know, when I was growing up in the Philippines in the 70s and 80s,
you know, culturally,
it was very different. Gay people weren't as out as they are now. I think Filipinos in general are very out, open, and accepting of gay people now, especially compared to when I was growing up. So, you know, there was a shift.
I think a lot of the pressure was, in the Philippines, I would think the Catholic Church had a much stronger hold here in Canada. I mean, it was same religion was very, you know, and that was always the big sin. So I think there's a lot more talk and openness and stuff like that that's come along. But I think most people really don't care. You know, it's like, yeah, whatever. You know,
I mean, whatever the reason is behind that shift, I'm glad that it did happen.
Yeah.
And you know, young people now are so lucky, I think.
Yeah. I mean, there's although ever so often I meet young people that are, you know, still very or people even my age that are still very closeted. And I said, what are you doing? Who cares?
Well, you know, We say that it's more open now, but, you know, there are still pockets of those situations where people don't find it easy to come out. I think, you know, especially when you belong to a religious family, maybe.
For sure.
You know, so, you know, those pockets are still there. You know, certain parts of this country are a lot more conservative than others. So I feel for those young people stuck in, because the closet is not a fun place to be.
No, absolutely not. And with that sort of thinking in mind, now, when did you decide that you were going to take on nursing as a career? Because
Oh gosh.
I know now you're a mental health nurse, but at one point you must have started out just as, you know, sort of general nursing.
You know, I always say that nursing
by accident for me.
It just kind of, it was never a goal of mine to be a nurse. It just kind of happened. You know, the first year that I arrived in the U.S., I had just finished high school. I wasn't sure whether I was going to be accepted to college in the U.S. right away, especially because my high school degree was in the Philippines.
When
I arrived here. So I had to take these exams to kind of prove that I was proficient in English and all of these sort of things. And in that process, while I was waiting to do that and establishing residency in the U.S., my mother came across this program called, you know, an adult school program called a psychiatric technician program. So it's very similar to a licensed practical nurse. So back then, my goal was to take take up psychology in college. So when my mother came across this program, I said, "Oh, psychiatric technician, that's kind of close to what a psychologist would do, I think." So while I'm waiting for all of these things to happen, let me just take that program. And I became a psychiatric technician, which is in the nursing field. And then I just started working, and my employer put me through nursing school. And it just kind of snowballed from there. You know, I socialized with the right people at work. My feet were door back then, and somehow I managed to college with work paying for it. So
that's amazing. I mean, that's an amazing thing in and of itself. I mean, when you hear what people pay for education, and you know, just have your employer say, "I'll pay for it."
Yeah. So I was really, really lucky. And you know, I was in the mental health field already then, even as a technician. So it kind of just morphed into mental health nursing. And then in the subsequent years, I explored other forms of nursing under other nursing specialties. And I just found my way back.
Oh, okay. Now, so you're today, you're a mental health nurse.
You know, it's I don't know that I'm exactly a mental health nurse. I'm a jack of all trades in a way in nursing. The type of nursing I practice is very unique. And it's
is what we call it here
in California. And so I basically work
with
120 residents who were formerly homeless have been placed into this building in particular, and they have a history of, you know, chronic medical condition
dated by
severe mental illness or substance abuse in many cases.
Wow.
But
it's a very unique type of nursing.
So what would your day to day look like? I'm sure it's, you know, nothing's same old, but in general.
Well, I basically, I do a lot of medication management, you know, I hand people their medications. I communicate with, these residences, medical providers, when it's time to get refills. I basically serve between our residents and their medical providers.
Okay.
Them linked to care.
And you said there's 120. That's a lot of people. 120
residents, but you know, not every one of the 120 residents have acute needs all the time. So it's you know, maybe a certain percentage is more engaged in nursing services more than others. A vast majority of them are a lot more independent than others. You know, they're out and about doing their own thing, while some people need a little bit more care and services from us. And that could be in the form of medication management, as I mentioned. It could be case management. Mental health crisis situations happen. You know, and for that we do have, we also deal with, you know, a fair amount of deaths. Because yeah, a lot of these residents were homeless, so they were on the street for a long time with these chronic have just been going on for years, so their life expectancy, some of them, are not very long, unfortunately. So the goal
and
is...
I always think that's such an amazing thing. I mean, it's like, wow. I mean, shortened lives, too.
Yeah, so for those that, you know, are very severely sick, you know, very sick when they move into the building, you know, you basically try to make their lives as comfortable as possible in the weeks, months, and years that they have left. But
do
some
you,
of them,
you
know, at the same time,
population...
a lot of them thrive and live there for a very long time, healthy and productive members of society. And, you know, so it's, you know, very different from one another.
Okay. So, but I mean, it would be, I mean, similar to your own general practitioner, you know, he would have, you know, all these cases, but they're not all, you know, not everybody's sick at the same time or, you know, as bad as anybody else.
Some are very good with taking their medications. Some have very poorly controlled diabetes, for instance, or hypertension problems. And some are really, really good and are doing well. So
do you find it a rewarding occupation?
Very much so, in that when people ask me whether I like my job, I always say that I don't just like my job, I actually love my job. I'm very lucky now to have this job that I've been doing now for this particular job for 11 years. And I can say even after 11 years that I still love it.
That's amazing. That is amazing. Yeah. Because I mean, even that whole area of medicine, I mean, mental health, that's that can be a real pressure cooker. And, you know, although I have a friend who also works in the mental health and he said, the good thing about my job is, he said, there's no day that's like the other day. So he's the same as you. He's like, I just love it, you know. And he said, I love the people that I work with, and you know, it's, he said, they're sort of family to me in one way.
You know, it's a very, it's the type of nursing that it's either you love it or you hate it. There's no
for sure.
I know a lot of nurses who say, I don't know how you do it, I would never want to work in that type of a setting, but this is where I feel comfortable. I feel like I know what I'm doing. Situations. If you put me on a regular hospital floor, I would not know how to even. It's a very different world. You know, it's a very, very different world. And you're forced to, and as a nurse in this setting, you're forced to be independent. You kind of have to figure out situations on your own to the outside medical providers. Most settings, and there's doctors that are always there and available. I don't have that luxury.
Right.
So make certain decisions on my own, as long as they're within the scope of my practice, and then I just later.
Well, it's when you were saying that, it reminded me, I used to travel all through Canada's high Arctic. So, I mean, way up there, like 200 miles south of the North Pole. In every one of those villages, I would always meet up with the local nurse, just because in some of those villages, she was the only, she was the only white person around. So, you know, they would say, hey, I see you're visiting the community. Why don't you come over and we'll have coffee or something like that. And their whole life is like, they say, you know, we're it, we're the medical for this community. We're it. So we deliver babies. We remove harpoons from people's legs. We, you know, like she said, if it's major surgery, hopefully we can get a doctor in or get them out to a bigger clinic. But, you know, and 99% of them were like, I couldn't work in a hospital in the South because, you know, it's just like, I love it. You know, it's I get to do everything.
First of all, I'm lucky that my extreme.
Well, I mean, they would just, I mean, some of them would tell me stories that would be like, oh my God. But they would just laugh and they say, you know, we've been doing it for, you know, 20, 30 years. And, you know, we see where there has to be changes, but hey, sometimes you're it. They can't get a plane in because it's too much snow or, you know, or hey, I guess I'll have to do this surgery myself. And it's like, whoa.
Well, I guess my type of nursing that I do. In a much less extreme situation than what you're describing, luckily.
Well, but I also felt bad for them because they said, you know, once, you know, drugs and alcohol, you know, were coming in, I mean, the suicide rates were going up and it was just, you know, they said it was just hell, just pure hell for them, you know.
Yeah.
But, yeah, because the whole mental health issue. And I'm sure you, where you are, I mean, you look and say, wow, we need to make some drastic changes here in policies and, you know, with the government and things like that. I mean, you've mentioned to me about it in San Francisco, the amount of people living on the streets. And I've shared with you here in Vancouver, we have the same situation. And it just seems to be a growing challenge. You know, what do we do next?
It's an unfortunate and tragic kind of development, you know, especially more maybe in the past decade, you know, that it's the mm-hmm. situation has just gotten so bad, I think, in major cities. And apparently, you know, after speaking to you about Vancouver, I was surprised that was also happening in Canada because, you know, I've always maybe idealized Canada. And, you know, so it's happening there. But, you know, it's not just San Francisco. It's happening in Southern California in the LA area. You know, it's just that maybe it seems a little bit more magnified here in San Francisco because we're a much smaller city.
Mm,
you know,
for sure.
You know,
and I think that's partially in Vancouver too. I mean, we're not like Toronto, which has 3 million people and things like that, but still it just seems, wow, you know, you go down to the east side and it's just, you know, I always hate when I see them tearing down the tent cities and, you know, coming in and moving the people. And it's like, oh, why can't we figure this out, you know?
You know, it's very difficult. But, you know, apparently it's just really very difficult to find that kind of allowing people to live their lives, but at the same time, as long as it's, I guess, not intruding upon the lives of others.
Mm-hmm.
Life of others. You know, so it's a fine balance.
For sure.
Thankfully I'm not, but you know, I've got my opinion about it. You know, I don't know that, you know, it's the right that, you know, I have my opinions.
The views expressed are not necessarily those of
yes,
the government of San Francisco.
You know, especially with the line of work close to it, you know, every day of the, you know, every day of the, my work week, you know, that's kind of like the population that I serve. You know, they're off the streets now, but you know, that situation before. So, you know, I'm kind of exposed to the culture, I guess is how I can say it.
Yeah. And I think there's certain people that, I mean, that's where they're comfortable. It's like, gosh, I really like this. I like helping this part of society, and I'm comfortable with that, you know, and I salute them. I truly do.
You know, it's very rewarding. It's very rewarding when somebody moves into the building and, you know, after a little while of stabilizing, you know, medically and psychiatrically, it's a very rewarding feeling.
I have a cousin who's a pastor in a city, Windsor, Ontario, and his whole ministry is he has a church in amongst the homeless, and he said, I love these people. And he said, I wouldn't want a regular congregation. Like he said, I go and speak about my church to some of these other congregations in order to get money because he feeds them, clothes them, and stuff like that. But he said, when I go to those places, it's like, wow, you know, I miss my congregation. I miss hanging out with them. And, you know, he said, well, you know, you have some pretty odd services once in a while where somebody comes in there. I wouldn't say it's necessarily high on the spirit of God, but it's fun, you know? And he said, probably most of my congregation comes so that they can use the church washroom to clean up for the week. You know, yeah. He said, you walk into that washroom and it's like, oh, there's naked people in here sort of bathing. How interesting.
Hey, it's a calling, you know, and
exactly. And exactly. He and his wife just like love
that. That enjoy oh, what I they
know.
Do.
I know Kevin. Kevin is just awesome. And I mean, his wife told me last year, she said that one of the ladies who brings everything she owns in a grocery cart was saying, where's Pastor Kevin? Where's Pastor Kevin? And I said, oh, he's just over there. And she found or stole this really smelly coat. And she said, as soon as I saw this, I knew that I had to get it for you for Christmas. And she said, my crazy husband wore that thing. And she said, I'm like, Kevin, we need to clean this first. He said, no, I'm going to wear it for a little while, just like it is. I like it. It's worn in, you know, it's probably going to be popular and I could sell it on Facebook and it'll be worth like millions. But it's just, that's his attitude, you know, and he and his wife, such wonderful, wonderful people. You know, he said, the only thing that bothers me, he said, like, they live right in the area. And he said, every time I brag about the people, something happens the next week. Like he did a podcast with me and he said, what's really funny is the next week, somebody stole my security system off the front of the house.
Oh,
I was just like, but he said, the good thing is all I have to do is go for a walk down some of the alleys and start mentioning I'm missing my security system and somebody knows who stole it.
Wow.
Yeah. So I said, do you go get it back? I said, no, I just tell them, please don't steal my system ever anymore. And I just go out and buy a new one. You know, but I said, well, you should get one that works because that one obviously didn't because it got stolen.
That's so true.
on a totally different note, we have talked and you do solo travel.
I love like, solo travel.
How did that happen? Like, it's just all your friends said, we can't travel with you, so you're going to have to travel on your own? Or you said, yeah, I don't like traveling.
Everyone got tired of traveling with me, so I didn't have... I'm just kidding.
They were saying to you, Vincent, we're going to the Philippines this year. We suggest you go to China.
Yes, that's how it started. No, I'm just kidding. It actually started out as a challenge. You know, years ago, you know, I had these two friends that said, don't even talk about going there by yourself. I think I was talking about going to Germany or wherever.
Okay.
Says you'll never go by yourself. You won't know what to do, whatever, yada, 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 that I can't do it. Mm-hmm. So basically I took it as a challenge. You know, I kind of
like,
oh yeah, well, I'm going to show you I can. And so I did. And I ended up just having such a blast that it just thing. Now I try to make it a point to go somewhere solo, maybe every other trip. You know, I love still going traveling with friends and family, but I also make it a point to make time for just me, solo travel.
Which is a good thing.
Yeah, it's definitely very different. The question of where are we going, when are we going, or how long are we going for, you don't have to ask a group of people. You just decide for yourself. You know, it's like, this is where I'm going, this is when I'm going, and this is how long I'm going for.
And even when you're on the vacation, you can decide whether you're going to stay in that night or go out.
Yeah. You know, the independence or selfishness, if you want to call it that way. It's just a rare opportunity to call all the shots.
Sometimes it's like when you travel through your
day, and just learning to enjoy your own company.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't realize I'm so much fun by myself. You know, there's so many things to solo travel that I just.
Well, there is a part that I think a lot of people don't get is you can be alone without being lonely, you know? I've done solo travel myself, and I'm like, people say, oh, it must be so lonely. I said, no, I'm surrounded usually with people that are in the country. I'm not walking out into the middle of the desert, but,
you know, I
enjoy my own company.
You know, if you're the lonely type, who knows, this might even be a good way for you to look into something like this. And maybe it will help you realize that, hey, I'm spending several weeks on your own on vacation is actually not lonely, that it's actually a lot of fun.
When my kids were growing up, I used to say to them, look, before you jump into marriage, you know what? Go live on your own for a couple of years. Like, don't even have like a boyfriend or a girlfriend or anybody, living in the same place as you. Learn to enjoy, find out who you are and say, I really like this person, you know? And I said, that's what I have done. And it's not a bad thing because it's, you know, you're not bound to anything. I always hate going out with people and when we vacation together and the whole, what do you want to do? I don't know. Whatever you want to do. No. What do you want to do? Where do you want to eat? I don't care. Where do you want to eat? Oh.
I can't travel with needy people, first of all.
No. No.
Even when I'm also with others, it's nice to have, you know, a few hours here and there of alone time. You know what I mean? When somebody's constantly like pawing at you, that's not necessarily always fun.
No. You know?
I still take vacations with friends and I enjoy it immensely, but
yeah, but I mean, I think it's something that people shouldn't see as a negative, you know, it's like, try it, just at least try it, you know, go out.
A person on this earth need to experience solo travel at least once. Don't knock it till you've tried it.
Exactly, exactly. And you might come away just saying, I'm never vacationing with anybody ever again.
You know, I don't know that I would say that. I don't know that I would take it that far, but no, I enjoy
it. I have mental health issues. I have very major mental health issues, and only Ben knows about them. And no, I'm kidding.
I mean, even with us, when we travel, could be a good form of therapy, actually.
Mm-hmm.
For me.
Yeah.
So
it's like, yeah. I mean, so places you've gone on your own, are there places you say, I will definitely return there?
Oh, many, many. Yeah. I enjoyed Madrid on my own. You know, mm-hmm. I was just in the Baltics a couple of months ago. I was also in France and Belgium around that same time. All of those places I would
go.
You know, there's
any places you say
places that I've been to solo.
True. I actually think there's so many beautiful places in the world. You know, I mean, of course, I guess beauty is in the eye of the beholder, but I could take, I mean, it doesn't sound appealing, but I love it. If you go up into the high Arctic, out onto the, you know, I mean, whether it's the Arctic Ocean in the summer or Arctic Ocean in the middle of winter, it's beautiful. It's just beautiful. So quiet and beautiful. And the people themselves are fun. You don't like
you
the
do
cold.
You, Paul. I mean, you have you. To
yeah, exactly.
You do you.
I have a.
As
when
I've
I was traveling through the
weather,
Arctic,
has become a little.
Why don't people want to travel with me? I don't understand. Mind you, I built and slept in an igloo, so I have that under my belt. I've done, you know, dog team, go on a sled, dog sled, stuff like that. I mean, you know, it's just very different. I was up there for other reasons, but I enjoyed it just the same. Any places you say, I don't think I'd go back there. That wasn't so good.
You know, I not necessarily I wouldn't go back there, but more that I wouldn't go back there solo.
Okay.
Because maybe the experience was just not necessarily as pleasant as all the other experiences. In particular, I guess I might as well say it. Maybe the Middle East. You know, it was a little bit different traveling by myself to Turkey.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. I've heard that.
As beautiful as Istanbul was, you know, it's, you know, when you're obviously a tourist, people look at you differently and,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's just, maybe it's the political situation,
true
in the Middle East, but you know, and traveling solo as you know is maybe also, you know, in
true,
you know, when I travel I have to look behind my back, you know, I just don't want to look look for certain situations,
sure.
You know, like or looking to avoid certain situations. It's
right,
when you start doing
exactly.
that, when you start doing that, the vacation just becomes different, gives it a very different flavor.
True, true enough. I've traveled to, and I'm really hoping the whole thing in Israel's, you know, comes to a stop really soon. For many reasons, but I've been to Israel and Jordan, that whole area, about five times. Not for the religious settings all the time, but man, I so enjoyed just the historical aspects of it and the people themselves. You know,
I would go back.
Yeah,
I mean, not necessarily go back solo. Probably back and travel solo. I still would. You know, not in the current climate.
Yeah.
when the current situation.
Oh gosh.
Is it an exemption? I don't know.
Who knows who's going to listen to this, right? I just don't want people to misconstrue what I'm saying.
No. I traveled in Zambia, in Africa. Oh my gosh. It was the first time I'd ever in my life realized what it was like to be the only white person, you know?
It's
a little freaky.
It's Africa.
Never felt I was in danger, but it was just like, oh, okay. I mean, and like you say, some places you say, okay, I better keep both eyes open and pay attention, you know?
Yeah.
But beyond that. So where are you heading off to next for a solo travel? Or you haven't decided yet?
I'm planning. But it looks like it's going to be solo because a few of my friends actually, I mentioned, so it's a solo track. Yeah, I'm sure I will. I just came back 2 months ago. So many variables for 2024. So it's so many places that I want to see. Happens that some of my best friends are actually wanting to go. So it's going to be fun. But
that I will
come up with. There are many places that I would love to travel to solo.
Still.
Well, I mean, yeah. And you've got your health and you got a little bit of cash. Go for it, you know?
I don't know about the latter part, but I'm sure.
Well,
I could,
folks, you can send your checks payable to Vincent at the Beehive.
Go fund.
For those of you that are terrified to travel alone, he will do it on your behalf and send you pictures.
I would blog it for you.
Yeah. Oh, wow, folks. You've heard it here. You need to write me and I will pass this on and he will start a major blog. Hey, listen, a very good friend of mine, her son graduated out here in university in business, and he was hired by a very large firm out here. The first vacation he and his buddy went to Thailand. And while they were in Thailand, they were going down a back road and saw this thing that said, feed an elephant a bucket of bananas for $5. So they were like, hey, let's do it. While they're doing this, feeding the elephant reached around and grabbed his cell phone took a selfie of them. The elephant took the selfie.
No way.
And he just said, you know, and laughed with his friend. He said, can you believe it? That's unbelievable. And the trainer said, wow, he's never done that before. They
that
posted
really
it.
Cool.
And you know what this guy does now? He quit his job and he practically lives in all these places showing people how to have an enjoyable vacation for next to nothing. That's his whole life. She said, here we paid for his university education. He goes off on a vacation. I mean, he had like a million hits on that one. What do they call it? Elfie or elephant elf, a selfie or something like that. Yeah. And that's how he became famous. And she said, my son now lives with a girlfriend in Bali. And he said, that's all he does is blogs and shows people how to manage throughout these countries.
Wow. That's amazing.
He's living our dream. He's living our dream.
Well, elephant tours are it's just
a matter of
making the right tours where
yeah
did well, you know, the sand
Well, and that's part of what he does as well. Although I always tell people the other thing that the only animal that I won't go on is a camel. They stink. I can't stand the smell of the camel. And then after you get off them, you still stink. You know, I hate that.
Yeah, I did that in Egypt. And yeah, I see what they mean.
Well, and one of while I was in Israel, somebody gave me a it was a wallet made out of camel leather. Seriously, that thing stunk. I had to throw the wallet out. I was like, oh my God, I think it smell out of this wallet. It was like I would have it in my jacket and people go, did you crap yourself? I said, no, it's this stupid camel thing. Finally took my money and credit cards out of it and threw the thing out. It's like, oh, this is awful. It was camel? And the guy had told me, oh no, this is really good. It's cured in camel dung. I'm like, oh, cured? I think it's got a major disease. Oh, absolutely. On that note, Vincent, I want to thank you for being on my podcast. And well, you're living the life for some people, I'm sure, when they hear this. And let me just say this to those of you that are listening. I mean, like it, share it. And if you want to ask Vincent questions, there's an email address there for me, and I will send them on to Vincent. And if he's not somewhere else in the world or, you know, up on a mountain all by himself, I'll make sure he gets them and he'll get back to you. But other than that, again, Vincent, thank you so much.
Having me.
And if you ever get up here to Vancouver, let us know. And we'll be sure
careful
to
what you wish. Take it up on that.
Well, no, we'll just go off on a vacation. We'll leave you the keys to stay there. He doesn't like being with people, Ben. I told you he hates people.
I'm about due for a Canadian trip, actually. So, hey, you never know.
Well, your money goes further here. Your money goes way further here. So, again, thank you so much, sir.
Good night.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Take care.